Mr. Speaker.
You're at the intersection of business and politics. This is the 14th and G podcast from Melman Consulting. Now, here's our host, Dean Hinkson.
Thank you for sending your podcast out of 14th and G. Yes, I am your host, Dean Hinkson, here high atop the historic Colorado building in downtown Washington, D.C.
Possibly soon to be a hotel.
In the 14th and G Worldwide Studios with Republican Bruce Melman and Democrat David Thomas. We're going to cover all of 2025 in 25 minutes or less, or it's free. Bruce Melman, David Thomas, welcome to 14th and G.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you, Dean.
Well, golly, guys, there's no shortage of things to talk about. The reconciliation bill continues to wind its way through the machinations of the People's House. We've got the president back from his grand Middle East tour and has gone straight to Capitol Hill as the chief whip to get his troops in line. News about President Biden, very sad, who we wish hopefully a good and strong recovery. The economy, tariffs, we think Elon Musk has left town, though we're not sure. And DT, don't let me forget, I know you have views on the Diddy trial. We will get to before we're done. But where do you want to start? I guess we should start at reconciliation.
Cause that's the one big, beautiful bill, OB3.
The OB3, the OBBB. That is taking up all of the political oxygen right now. The House is moving fastly and furiously to get this done. In fact, the Rules Committee is going to meet at 1 o'clock in the morning, not to waste a second of time. We heard there were fireworks in the House Republican Conference today with President Trump up on the Hill. They get it done because they have to get it done, and I really don't think this can slip into June for the House. So maybe our colleague Sage Eastman makes a great point. Backed up against the Memorial Day recess, that is graduations, that is weddings. At some point, you are going to start to lose members, and Speaker Johnson only has five to work with.
Not even five.
Where are we at now? Four?
Well, no, it's once you lose. I forgot the members of the Democratic caucus who deceased gives him a couple more slots, but Massey's a permanent no.
Pat Massey's a permanent no. But you got to get, you can't lose. Maybe they're all chirping and making noise, but Democrats can just kind of sit on the sidelines and chirp from the cheap seats on this one.
We've been pretty good at sitting on the sidelines for the past 6 months. So I suspect that'll continue through the weekend for the Dems. As we look at where we are here now, the president gave this big, I'm unclear if it was a big rah-rah speech, like a halftime speech from a football coach or a berating. He came out and he said, there was a lot of love in that room. I think you're right, though. The Republicans, they have to get this done. If they don't get this done, they're running out of runway here to get this bill to the president's desk. The one of the big challenges is you've got the debt ceiling raise as part of this process here. Dean, you know better than anybody else how long it's going to take to get this through the Senate once it gets over there. So it's almost comical to me that there's all this debate on what the House is going to do when you know the Senate is going to put their stamp on it and send it back and they're going to have to eat it. So, we'll see what happens starting tonight at 1 a.m. in the Rules Committee. I think maybe we should do our first live podcast at 1 a.m. and just see how it goes.
I know Melman is an early to bed, early to rise.
It's almost wake up time at 1 a.m.
It's almost time to just get up.
No, Scout, the Bernadoodle and I will have been sleeping for about 5 hours by then.
You've got people who have policy concerns, and it's the more moderate coastal Republican swing seat guys on SALT, maybe on Medicaid as well. And then the Freedom Caucus, who are mad because it's not cutting enough. Because they don't want to do SALT and they don't want to do and they want Medicaid cut more in addition to other things here. It seems like you squeeze one side of that balloon, it's going to pop out on the other side here. So totally. I don't know how you get to yes, other than we've seen this act before where the president is on the phone or shows up in the cloakroom and berates them until they vote the right way. They may need to do that again.
One quote I heard from the conference meeting from Trump was he looked at the SALT caucus guys and said, Nobody cares about your blue state governors and their ridiculously high tax rates. Get on board and get this done. I mean, look, they, you know, the
good luck with that campaign for New York governor.
Well, look, it's the stop representing your districts and start representing me.
Right.
That was the point.
That's the point.
That's
the point.
Sounds good in an odd numbered year. It's a bad thing to have thrown back in your face in an even numbered year.
The SALT deduction's been tripled to 30,000. It's capped. The increase is capped at 400,000 in income. You've got that. You've got the Medicaid. You're right. Like, all right. So let's take this. I think that I do think the House still gets this done before they leave for Memorial Day, just because they have to. As you alluded, DT, we got lots of work to do in the Senate. First off, they'll have to do the Byrd process that makes this bill compliant with reconciliation so that it remains privileged and they can skip the Senate filibuster. That's the whole point of this thing. But you've got senators concerned, also concerned with SALT. You've got senators concerned with the Medicaid cuts, how much and how much it impacts current beneficiaries. And don't sleep on the energy tax credits. You've got a pretty good locus, I think, of Republican senators who care about some of the energy tax credits that are being stripped out here. This is going to come back a bit of a different bill, or maybe a lot of a different bill. And the Senate, the House is just going to have to go through the 12 stages of grief to get to acceptance at some point.
I feel like it's the biggest challenge for the, you know, for Senator Thune and for Speaker Johnson yet. But they've been successful for the past 6 months, for the most part, of getting things through when the president leans in. He is his own director of legislative affairs, and he's his own whip in the House of Representatives in the Senate. It's going to require him to lean in again. The only sure no votes are the guys from Kentucky, Massey and Paul. That's it. I think everybody else he likely browbeats into voting his way.
By the way, it's 5 stages of grief. It's 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just saying. Probably popped into your mind for no reason whatsoever.
Thanks for checking me on that.
So you're saying we need 17 steps.
I just know that anger is in there, denial, bargaining, and you finally get to acceptance. So thank you for checking me on that, Bruce.
It's important.
Yeah, and look, the hammer down strategy has worked for Speaker Johnson, and that, you know, we know that strategy works until it doesn't.
But it's not his hammer. It's the president's hammer.
It's not his hammer. It's not his hammer. You're absolutely right.
As opposed to, like, they want to get this done, not least of which, because imminent court rulings are going to take away, what is it, $300 billion of pay-fors. They've got a very Washington, very inside baseball pressure, but the real pressure is the debt ceiling. And the X date is probably early September. These guys, I mean, at the end of the day, they ought to rip the Band-Aid off, but who gives? Historically, the answer is the Bruce Melman moderate wing of the Republican Party that isn't crazy is always the guys who blink. And always, you know, even though the moderates, the districts that are actually at risk, they're still the ones typically who are asked, suck it up and get in line. But I hope they can get it done sooner because it's a hell of an overhang. But at the same time, I'm racking my brain. When did they get, in a neat, orderly way, something done before the deadline was really a
deadline? And look, and just to sort of tease that out a little bit, the debt limit increase, which we need to maintain the government's borrowing authority, is baked into this bill. And administrations past have used that deadline to drive action on a lot of things. And, you know, it's almost completely until you actually hit the real deadline. It's actually almost completely within the administration's, the Treasury Secretary's control. Right now, Secretary Bessent has said it runs sometime in mid-August, which means he needs the debt limit increase done around mid-July, which, surprise, surprise, about the time this bill should be circling the drain or the finish line, depending on your point of view. You know, when they activate that, that's when they're ready to drive final action. And you have to fully expect
certainly
that's how
you sure as hell don't want to go home for August recess with this thing not done.
You can't. I don't think you can. I don't think you can.
We'll see.
We will see. Lots more to come. Well, the president seemed to have the president seemed to be very well received in Qatar. Probably better.
True. I agree with that statement.
Probably better received than he
it's
was
like
in the
Jerry
House
Lewis in France. He's huge in the Emirates.
He's huge in the Emirates. He's huge in the Emirates. The ladies were whipping their hair around, and the crown prince met him at the stairs, which I think somebody said was a breach of protocol, but it's just how much he thinks of President Trump. We got a jet out of the deal and lots of other things.
It is, this is the whole, I don't know how we're going to do this for another 3.5 years. It has become so commonplace to have the outrageous. With so many things thrown up against the wall and so much happening at one time, the fact that he was presented with a plane worth $400 million, which he himself admits will then be transferred to his library when he leaves office, presumably so he can then fly around the country in that plane, is I don't have any words. I'm speechless on this stuff anymore. And yet we move on and it will be forgotten.
Oh, I don't know. The Clinton Foundation may have a playbook somewhat similar to this.
Hillary took an end table. Get over it. And she returned it.
Well, so two things about that. One, the president now has said he won't take it to the library because the voice of reason, Laura Loomer, along with Charlie Kirk and others, came out and said, this is ridiculous. I beg you to reconsider. To me, though, not to get all serious and nerdy on you boys.
I put my money on the plane. I know he likes those two knuckleheads, but he really likes fancy planes.
They've got a retrofitted. It won't even be ready while he's still president, defense-wise. But to me, the really interesting thing that happened over there with all of the wacky stuff aside is in artificial intelligence, where the Biden diffusion rule was going to make it a lot harder for leading American chip companies to sell the high-end chips that the nations in that region wanted so that they can try to become leaders in data centers and leaders in artificial intelligence. And the Trump administration has clearly sided with our AI champions for two reasons. First, on the theory that if our chips are hard to get and China continues to advance their chips, we're going to lose pretty critical market share. But second, it shows you a bit of a geopolitical shift. You know, President Biden came into office saying, I'm going to make Saudi a pariah nation. And it's very clear President Trump sees the oil-rich nations in the Middle East as critical strategic allies that he seems to trust enough to be on the cutting edge of data center and AI technology.
Is that what we think it was? Because he trusts them so much and he has such a good relationship there? They rolled out a bunch of camels to welcome him on arrival and escort him into the palaces, the gold-plated palaces,
and
which, by the way, look
red,
like the Oval Office now looks like it should be in one of those palaces. He's got so much gold-plated crap all over it. I remember a time when the not that long ago, when the first trip the president of the United States, a new president, would take was to Canada to visit our closest ally and neighbor. George W. Bush did it differently, and everybody was sort of shocked because he went to Mexico first.
It was the brown suit of
right.
Global protocol.
I note for the record that when was the last time we had a president who visited those three countries in the Gulf and didn't go to Israel to see our ally there? I thought that was curious that he is making a run here, that he says he wants to negotiate with Iran, and he's doing, again, it's all these norm-breaking things that so much is getting thrown at us, you can't even wrap your arms around it.
Well, it's reflective of at least their view that that we are reordering our relationships with the rest of the world. A huge part of that is the trade agenda and the tariffs. Last time we were together, it was the wake of Reconciliation Day.
Liberation Day.
Today is Reconciliation
Today
Day.
Today is Reconciliation Day. Thank you, Bruce. Liberation Day. I believe you said your 401k had been liberated. Our 401ks have made an entire revolution around the sun to come back to where they started from. You know, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's Europe, whether it's India, all these other countries sort of, it's a new day in global relations. We've got the deal with the UK, and we've got a pretty big pause on China. See how that plays out, but not a lot of other deals announced.
Well, and look, that reflects two things, I think. One, President Trump is transactional. President Biden was much more ideological. So Trump just wants the best deal in his mind right now, generally on economic terms. But two, I think we have shifted from the old world. It used to be bipolar, then it was unipolar, Western America-led alliances, to a multipolar world. At the end of the day, Saudi's on Saudi's side. India is on India's side. And Ian Bremmer would describe it, instead of a G7 or a G20, it's a G0. There is no single nation that the rest of the world looks to and says they're lighting the path, they're leading the way. This is a trend that we've seen that under both Trump administrations has accelerated. But at the end of the day, this is where the world is going. We work with, as you guys know, a lot of businesses that are trying to figure out how to remain a globally integrated, worldwide supply chain leader who sells in markets and leads around the world, but is both U.S. flagged, but not burdened with the U.S. flag. And that's a growing challenge.
Yeah, and we don't know, you know, it's a great point, and Trump's made it pretty clear, America should be on America's side, and that's it. America first, and that agenda, it's what it's all about. We've got some flashing lights on the economic indicator dashboard, though, right? Bond markets getting, yields are rising. We're getting a little fuzzy there. Bond market controls the world. Markets don't quite seem to know where they're going to go next. Mortgage rates are now pretty consistently up over 7%. There are some concerning things here, and if you don't give businesses some certainty on the supply chain front, on the regulatory front, on the tax front, which is a big part of what this reconciliation bill is about, we have some risks there on the economic side.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. There's a ton of risk right now, and I think
Moody's just downgraded, which is maybe old news.
No, but that's a big deal too. I think, you know, we've talked a lot about what are the guardrails that this president has, what causes him to change course here, and we thought it might be the stock market, but he still sort of pushed forward here.
Totally.
But I think some of these blinking red lights in the economy. Feels like to me that since Liberation Day, he's been negotiating against himself. Like, we haven't seen a bunch of these big deals. The UK deal was in a deal to announce that they will continue to have discussions. That's kind of nonsense. The China deal, he basically ratcheted those down. It almost felt like on his own, but they're not real discussions, I feel like, going on to try to resolve that situation. We were sort of, you're always waiting for the next shoe to drop. And so it's a real challenge for the clients that we work with to try to find any sort of certainty here when it just seems like he goes from guardrail to like guardrail.
Well, look, certainty aside, it seems to be the second 100 days of the Trump administration have two core prongs. One is they want to get the animal spirits alive again. The theory of Liberation Day was the art of the deals theory of make your initial demand so extreme, maximalist, and outrageous that your negotiating partners are happy when they only have to give up a quarter as opposed to the whole loaf you were asking for. Whether that helps, I don't know. But they're hoping with tax, they're hoping with deregulation to excite markets. Concurrently, the most interesting part of the second 100 days is we're starting to see all of the lawsuits that have been brought against the administration, more than 350 so far, which have yielded more than 160 injunctions, temporary injunctions or pauses. You know, an executive order can be done in a flash. A court case goes through due process, district court, appeals court, Supreme Court, but they're increasingly ripening. I would imagine within the second 100 days, we will affirm that the Impoundment Act of 1974 means what it says on its face, that you can't impound. Some of the things I'm thinking about USAID may be broken, and even if the court says you're not allowed to break it, it will be interesting if it could even be put back together. Some of the things I assume the administration will do what the Biden folks did on student debt relief when they tried to do $500 billion and they were told you as a president don't have the power of the purse, you can't do it. Subsequently, in the next 2 years, they kept doing far smaller bites under different statutes and different authorities. So they never got back to the $500 billion, but they did many billion dollars more. I would imagine that's the Trump approach. But that's what I'm watching really closely. Can they move the economy again through deregulation, through tax certainty, through even if these are term sheets, through a sense that we're not heading over the falls on trade, while concurrently these court battles are going to be really interesting. And does the administration say we're going to need a lot of legislative help? Do they say, like I thought, we're going to find alternative paths? Or do they say what President Andrew Jackson said? I read Justice Marshall's opinion. Now let's see him enforce it.
How many divisions hath the Supreme Court? Well, you know, part of, we talk about this in our presentation work, part of what's going to determine the path forward is how dynamic and how quickly a resistance coalesces around President Trump. Whether it's the Move On, Code Pink movement against Bush, the Tea Party movement against Obama, the first Trump resistance was very famous and I think pretty effective. But it doesn't seem like Democrats are done with the circular firing squad, particularly with regard to, and I want to say it's very sad news, President Biden's cancer diagnosis that recently came out. Wish him a full and speedy recovery. But it all plays into this. Who knew what when? Why was he propped up for so long and then put in a position that almost ensured Trump's victory in the 2024 election?
There's a book on that.
There is a book on that.
I think there are more than a few books on that, but one comes out today.
I am an hour in on my commute in this morning. It's the real deal. It is fascinating. I read Fight already, which was terrific. That's a little bit of a broader look, a lot more insight into the Harris campaign. But this obviously is all about Biden. And of course, to your point, you know, the recent diagnosis, I certainly wish him well. There's going to be a lot of talk. You don't wake up and find you have a Gleason score of 9 and stage 4 prostate cancer. So there's going to be a lot more talk about that. Hoping that we can get past it, although this does create moments for the Babylon Bee, who had a release today. Karine Jean-Pierre insists Joe Biden is cancer-free, which I thought was pretty funny in for what they do.
Well, look, and I just have to say, it's a little rich that we're talking about the Jake Tapper book, famous CNN talking head. It's a little rich that the guy who's pretty much at the head of the media establishment that ran cover for Biden, whatever was going on, is now... has a blockbuster bestseller on the subject.
I'm sorry, did I just show up in the Bannon podcast here? where are my friends?
Go. Well, by the way, that was the other Babylon Bee was Jake Tapper uncovers startling evidence that Biden's decline was covered up by Jake Tapper.
Should I just pull up the Onion right now and I can start reading headlines here?
If they're funny.
As well. Dems, I'd sort of hoped we'd be finding our way sort of out of the wilderness in 6 months here. I think it's going to take a little longer, and maybe that's okay. I'm not all that. I'm not pulling a fire alarm yet. That the Dems are they're done forever here. Why is that? Because Republicans don't tend to do, or not Republicans. Any president does not tend to do well in midterm elections. We can go all the way back to Harry Truman. And almost every president has lost seats and a significant number of seats in their party in the midterm elections. There are only two people who beat the odds there. It was Clinton in 98, Bush in 2002. Every other one, they lost seats and in most cases get clobbered. So I think that gives Dems a little bit of hope here that within the next 18 months, if they can get their mojo back, the midterms could be well for them. That said, there's a lot of work to do here. I do think there's a good bench of possible Democrats who can sort of rise up to fill that void. The biggest challenge is, how does anybody get any oxygen when Donald Trump is in the room? Like, we've been talking about him for 10 years. I am so tired of talking about him, and we've still got 3+ years to go.
Yeah, sorry. And you're 100 days in.
He'll probably run for a third term, and then I'm going to have to talk about that with you two some more. He'll just never, ever leave.
I hate to tell folks, but we are going to be talking about the midterm elections here before too long. We're almost never out of cycle in this town, but lots to come on that. David, I ran completely out of time to get your hot takes on the Diddy trial. I promise you, the next time we're together in this studio, you will talk about the Diddy trial. Until then, I bid you all a fond farewell. Bruce Melman, David Thomas, thank you for joining me on 14th and G.
Thank you, Dean.
Thank you, my friend.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast, brought to you by the lobbying firm of Melman Consulting. For more, just type 14th and G podcast into your favorite search engine or look for 14th and G wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe.
Beam me up, Mr. Speaker.